for the weekend, let me say that Comrade Ward is a Marxist lecturer and writer whose articles you'll see in the International Socialist Review, which is on sale in the bookstore. And if you know follow these articles, you'll see he's a very competent person to discuss the topic that we have tonight, humanism and socialism. Comrade Ward.
It's been customary at the wind-up of the West Coast School to deal with some topic of fundamental and timely importance to the socialist movement, not only nationally, but internationally. Some of you may wonder why we have chosen the topic of socialism and humanism this year. The reason is that this question is coming to the fore in the minds of thinking socialists in various parts of the world, as I hope to demonstrate. The opponents of Marxism have long contended that its philosophy was vicious because of its materialism and avowed atheism, and that the politics flowing from this philosophy was pernicious and immoral because they stirred up class hatred and relied upon the methods of the class struggle. And nowadays, they have easy game by pointing to Stalinist totalitarianism as living testimony to the callousness and cruelties lodged in what they consider to be the real socialist movement. To be sure, the solicitude of such critics for human welfare doesn't prevent them from supporting a system which breeds fascism and military dictatorships, drops A-bombs on helpless civilian populations, sends troops to protect the profits of oil magnates, and keeps colored children from unsegregated schools. The socialist movement, which has dedicated itself to uprooting all such abominations, can very easily be defended against such arguments and accusations from pro-capitalist sources. We don't need to go to their schools or their examples for lessons of morality and humanism. But recently, we have been confronted with a challenge of a more serious kind, a questioning about Marxism's regard for humanity rising within the socialist camp itself. These voices rise from a number of places. One is that of the young radical intellectuals in Western Europe and England, who have become disillusioned and even repelled by the capitalist welfare state policies of the reformist socialist party, which pretends to be socialist, to go partway to socialism, even as we heard here, to have abolished poverty, and yet somehow the rich remain. The workers do not have control of their working conditions and the most vital problems of their lives. A good example of this tendency is this magazine, Universities and Left Review, published in England. This magazine came to life, as the young editors remarked, between the re-entry of Soviet tanks into Budapest and the first combined assault on Port Said in the ill-fated Suez Adventure. These young radicals have a programmatic editorial in their latest issue. They start by rejecting two propositions which are widespread among radicals. First, that socialism has culminated in the capitalist welfare state. The other is the simple identification of Stalinist regimes with the socialist half of the world. This twofold rejection of social democratic reformism on the one side and of Stalinism on the other is a very sound beginning of political enlightenment. It is indeed a very advanced one. It means that these oncoming spokesmen of the younger generation start by skipping two whole stages of working class evolution and even of decadence. So much for what they reject. What do they embrace? They are not quite so certain of their positive positions and programs. They are still groping their way toward these, but they tend toward what they call a revolutionary socialist humanism. And here is what they say about that. What we need now, more than ever, as we open up the undiscovered area beyond the welfare state, is a deep radical criticism of our society, a criticism informed by humanism, so little in evidence in either of the competing ideologies. Holding to the revolutionary perspectives of socialism, which could break out of the cramp of orthodoxy into the freedom of new possibilities. A restatement of the humanist basis is necessary, not only to purge away the crime committed in the name of socialism, but as a first premise in a new argument, as an indispensable beginning to coherent thought on what the word socialism means. This, then, is the socialist humanism toward which a significant group of young revolutionary-minded socialists in England and Western Europe are heading. Now let us go quite a bit east, into Eastern Europe, but not quite to the borders of the Soviet Union. We will come to that a little bit later this evening. There, as you know, there has been quite openly for several years a very deep-going ferment in all sections of the population against the existing regimes. In Hungary, Imre Nagy wrote a book called Morals and Ethics shortly before he was called back to power. In this book, there occurs the following paragraph, which I want to read to you. The party membership and the Hungarian people do not want a return to capitalism. They want a people's democratic system in which the ideals of socialism become reality, in which the ideals of the working class regain their true meaning, in which public life is based on higher morals and ethics. They want a system that is actually ruled not by a degenerate Bonapartist authority and dictator, but by the working people through legality and self-created law and order. They want a people's democracy where the working people are masters of the country and of their own fate, where human beings are respected, and where social and political life is conducted in the spirit of humanism. This is quoted in an issue of the National Guardian with the headline, "The Crimes for Which Imre Nagy Was Killed." You see that we are not talking about something merely of academic interest. Men's lives and heads are at stake in these issues. As a matter of fact, even long-held positions in the Communist Party of Los Angeles, I understand from the newspapers this week, are at stake, connected with this very question. But in order to arrive at a correct understanding of this deep-going problem, it is first necessary to take a historical review of the evolution of humanism in order to know what it is and what its history and achievements have been. And so, to begin with, after I hope I have impressed upon you the significance of what we are dealing with as socialists, let us go through the humanist tradition. I have here on the board the main stages in the development of the philosophy, the world outlook of humanism. Humanism is a much older philosophy than Marxism. In various periods, it has been an extremely progressive influence in human thought and social action. It first appeared as a distinct philosophical viewpoint among the Sophists in the Athenian city-state of the 5th century before Christ. There was at that time a democratic movement of the people led primarily by the merchant interests. Athens was the great merchant and naval power of the time, the most forward-looking progressive city in the Mediterranean. And in that mercantile republic, based upon slavery, there were wandering teachers of wisdom. And they shifted the focus of theoretical attention away from the phenomena of nature, of the heavens, and of the various other natural sciences in their embryo, which had engrossed the earlier Greek thinkers, shifted attention from those to the activities of the Greek citizen. They asked this question: what is the good life? How can it be attained in this world? And the answer that they gave was humanistic. It was not religious, and it was not, as a matter of fact, concerned with things outside the immediate concerns of the Athenian city. The most renowned of these sophists was named Protagoras. He not only diverted philosophy from nature, but from religion. He taught that neither nature nor the gods, but man was the measure of all things. I'm sure you have heard that aphorism at some time in your learning. Man is the measure of all things, both of those which are and of those which are not, and so on. And when it came to religion, Protagoras said in a book he wrote, the complete text of which has not been preserved, "As to the gods, I cannot say whether they exist or not. Many things prevent us from knowing. In the first place, the obscurity of the matter, then the brevity of human life." You see, he was one of the first agnostics, men who said they didn't know whether or not any God existed. For such teachings, he was accused of impiety, his books were burned, and he was driven from Athens. This humanist tradition runs through Greek civilization and goes on into Roman times. One of the most memorable utterances of humanism has come down to us from the Roman poet Terence. "I am a man, and nothing that concerns a man is a matter of indifference to to me. This maxim, which contains the essence of humanism in it, was a favorite of the French humanism, Michel Montaigne, whose essays you may have read, and also of the German materialist, whose name you may have heard, Karl Marx. Humanism was then eclipsed for a long time by Christianity. It reemerged only during the 14th century in Italy. It was one of the first rays of enlightenment coming from the nascent urban merchant culture from which bourgeois civilization arose. This was primarily literary in character. Its principal figures were literary men like Petrarch, the sonneteer, Erasmus, the essayist and purifier of Protestantism. This literary humanism of the Renaissance broke through the prison walls of medievalism. It opened a wider horizon on history than the narrow outlook of the Catholic Church and permitted fresh air to circulate through the stale atmosphere of scholastic thought, just as the present socialist humanism in the Stalinized countries are permitting the fresh air of socialist criticism and genuine Marxism to penetrate. I may add, it's even doing it outside of there. These scholars and artists immersed their minds in classical Greek and Roman life, going behind Christianity. They began to throw off the stultifying effects of the medieval monastery. They turned away from absorption in the afterlife and began to celebrate the joys of life on this earth. They took fresh delight in the human body and its sensations. They studied the conduct of mankind in preference to the mysteries of the actions of a divinity far above and beyond themselves. And such everyday interests of the Renaissance humanists led them to become re-educated. They educated larger bodies of citizens, helping them to set aside the worn-out values of Catholic supernaturalism and thus cleared a path for Protestantism and the bourgeois revolution. That was the second stage of humanism. The third stage was when it really came into flower. That was during the 17th, 18th, and partially in the 19th century. That was the high tide of humanism. It was associated with the most forward-looking tendencies of the bourgeois democratic revolution in France, in England, in the United States. It had a very radical and cosmopolitan spirit, best expressed in the life and work of the revolutionary propagandist Tom Paine. Perhaps some of you will recall that he declared, "The world is my country, and to do good is my religion." In the book of Charles Beard, we have been studying this week, The Rise of American Civilization, I came across a passage by Benjamin Franklin quite similar in spirit. Soon after his arrival in Philadelphia, he gathered around him a coterie of printers, shoemakers, and carpenters, common men, working men, who read books and thought things out for themselves. A group known as the Junto, which he called the best school of philosophy, morality, and politics that then existed in the province. Three questions asked of new members reveal the spirit of this strange academy. Do you sincerely declare that you love mankind in general, of what profession or religion soever. Do you think any person ought to be harmed in his body, name, or goods for mere speculative opinions or his external way of worship? Do you love truth for truth's sake? And will you endeavor impartially to find and receive it yourself and communicate it to others? This kind of humanism became a nursery for the revolutionary thinking which created the independence of our country. A little bit later, humanism came to be associated with certain advanced Protestant sects, like the Unitarians, who denied the divinity of Jesus, sought to rationalize and simplify or re-edit Christianity, adapting it to more modern outlooks. These Protestant sects substituted moral imperatives applicable to all mankind for theological dogmas. And even today, as we know, in some places, not too far from this camp, these churches provide refuges for political dissenters. At its extreme, this rationalism evolved into free thinking. Free thinking rejected God altogether. They no longer held on to that last shred or phrase or fig leaf of a God. Discarded the last vestiges of supernaturalism and made a cult of humanity in the abstract, stripped of their social condition. In the United States, this found religious organizations in ethical societies and community churches. Perhaps some of you have attended the so-called services of these groups. I did myself quite a bit in younger days. And they are not really a religious congregation at all. They are just sort of free liberal forums. In its heyday, humanism formulated the worthiest ideals of the bourgeois democratic revolution. It was one of the highest forms of the rationalism and individualism of the period of the bourgeois enlightenment. In certain respects, and in certain thinkers, it came very close to materialism. The German materialist Feuerbach, for example, one of the forerunners of Marxism, thought of himself as a humanist. Now let us come to contemporary humanism. I have called this liberal humanism, meaning that it is watered down from the wine of the revolutionary period of humanism. Present-day humanism is essentially an ethical attitude of cultivated city middle-class elements. They have torn up their traditional religious ties. They might have been Catholics, or one of the Protestants, or Jews, or whatnot. They become agnostic or atheistic, philanthropically inclined, and interested to some degree in social reform and political progressivism, sometimes to a considerable degree, to their honor. This kind of humanism can be one of the last stopping places on the way to socialism, provided people are moving in a progressive direction. Or, conversely, it can be one of the first stations on the road away from Marxism and one of the first perches in the flight from the class struggle. No doubt you know representatives of both tendencies. Now, what are the main differences between humanism and Marxism? Humanism adjoins Marxism at a number of points. Just as the progressive sections of the middle class and the workers have certain interests in common. Insofar as the humanists combat obscurantism and reaction in any field, defend science and promote education, support progressive measures and movements, including socialist movements, they have found allies among the Marxists. But having said that, we must go on to point out that humanism is no more than a neighbor of Marxism. They do not live under the same roof, politically and theoretically speaking. There are too many deep-going differences in philosophy and politics between them. They share certain general aims. Perhaps some of you have read Colas Lamont's book, The Philosophy of Humanism. It is an excellent work of its type, and he is undoubtedly the ablest American expounder of humanism, certainly the most popular. When he writes at the beginning that the chief end of human life is to work for the happiness of man upon this earth, and within the confines of nature that is his home, every scientific socialist will agree with him. Where the dividing point comes, however, is how do you get this and what agencies will get you there? The two schools of thought, socialism and liberal humanism, advocate incompatible methods of action and rely upon different social forces to realize what they conceive to be common objectives. And since the means are so closely bound up with the ends, these divergences manifest themselves in practice very forcefully at times. First of all, humanism is not a philosophy of the working class. It doesn't profess to be. It never was in its origin or its intention. And if you will read the philosophy of humanism, you will see that there is a very deliberate avoidance of any attempt to make a class outlook out of humanism. Humanism explicitly repudiates any specific class basis or affiliation. It bases its teaching not upon economic and specific social interests, but upon something quite different. Upon universal standards of ethics, which are supposedly binding upon all men, regardless of class, race, creed, color, and nationality. When you look at this historically, you see that it conforms to that abstract individualism, which is the substance of the ideology of bourgeois democracy. On its social and political side, humanism preaches the reconciliation of classes, as well as peace among nations, on the ground that the general interests and aims of all members of the human race transcend all their specific differences and social divisions. They infer where they do not state that through education, all ignorance and prejudice can be eradicated, and if you only address enough reasoned argument to exploiters, oppressors, and their like, appeal to the ethical conscience of individuals, that hostilities and similar social evils will sooner or later be done away with. So phrased, it is a secular version of the universal embrace of Christian brotherhood, minus a few things. The humanists leave out the fathership of God and the sonship of the Savior. But when you strip away the theological dress, the substance is exactly the same. Brethren, love ye one another. Marxism, on the other hand, proceeds from the material facts of the irreconcilable interests of the antagonistic classes in our society, pointing out that between the exploiters and the exploited, it is their differences and not their identities which come to the fore in all crucial cases. And from that conclusion, says that the struggle of the working people pursued to its maximum is the only way in which these evils will be eradicated and a better world brought forth. There's a direct clash there between humanism and socialism. In the second place, although many humanists are materialists in their rejection of supernaturalism, they are quite idealistic in their approach to history and the solution of social problems. For them, the motive force of historical progress doesn't come from the development of class conflicts brought about by changing economic conditions, but from the spread of democracy, intelligence, moral values, and ideals. These stand above narrow class considerations and crass material interests in their view. They can be radical democrats, social reformers, even moralistic socialists, but they are not scientific socialists or working class revolutionists. Carlos Lamont, for example, when it comes to the outlook on nature, is a thoroughgoing materialist. You will not find a trace of supernaturalism in his exposition of humanism. But when it comes to the reconstruction of society, he advocates what he calls the methods of reason, democracy, and science. Now these are, of course, good liberal methods. We don't reject the methods of reason, democracy, and science, except that we go on to say, when you apply them to the real facts of modern society, they lead you to understand that it is divided into classes, and only the methods of action which permit the struggle of the progressive forces to overcome those of the reactionary ones can you blaze the trail to a better life. For us, this is reason, democracy, and science. For the humanists, this is unreason. This is undemocratic and unscientific. So let us not be deceived by the abstraction of terms. We claim that reason, democracy, and science are in the service of the class struggle and the socialist revolution. The humanists do not. That is why, for example, Carlos Lamont and other humanists look to the United Nations as an arbiter above the conflict of classes in this world. We heard a little bit this afternoon about the Korean conflict, in which the United Nations showed that it was neither moral nor an instrument on the side of social progress and national independence in Asia. When it comes to the relations between strikers and strikebreakers as defenders of labor interests, we do not put them on the plane of equality, even although both belong to the human race and each may be motivated by the desire to earn a living for their families. In this case, the solidarity of the workers against the agents of their enemies stands above the abstract tie of belonging to the same human race. The same goes for the relations between the French imperialists and the Algerians. If an Algerian strikes at the French imperialists and their forces, we are on their side, although the methods may be as murderous and barbarous as the ones that their oppressors are trying to inflict upon them. The same is true in regard to the white supremacists and the Negroes. We believe that no matter what means the Negro uses to defend his dignity and his equality against the aggressions of the white supremacists, no matter what means he uses, we are on his side as against the forces of so-called white supremacist law and order. The trouble is in this sinful class society that human solidarity, when it comes to the real conditions of life, is split into two. We have two solidarities confronting each other. The solidarity of the oppressed and the exploited, and the solidarity of the oppressors and the exploited. And for us, it is the solidarity of those who are struggling for a better world against those who are striving to hold them down that is humanistic and right. So much for the tradition of humanism and the differences between humanism and Marxism. Now, for the last part of my talk, having told you a little bit about the socialist humanism of the young socialists in England and Western Europe, let us go over to the socialist humanism in the Soviet bloc. The socialist humanism, of which Imre Nagy is one representative, unfortunately we have to put that in the past tense. This humane socialism, that's in quotes, has sprung up like green grass between the cracks of a stone pavement in the countries of the Soviet bloc. It's a very progressive phenomenon. Through it, the writers, journalists, critics, and economists of Poland, Hungary, and the Soviet Union are giving voice to the grievances of the people against the evils of the bureaucratic regime. They're crystallizing and stimulating their feelings of indignation and injustice. You will recall that in the Tsarist Russia of the 19th century, literature was a prime vehicle of social criticism. In the irony of political development, literature is once again, in these same countries, becoming an instrument of mounting political opposition to the ruling power. This new humanism, and it's decidedly new because it's on a much higher historical level, is a many-sided, multicolored tendency. It runs the gamut of social problems, from law and ethics to economics and history. I could, as a matter of fact, spend a couple of hours giving you the details of it. It poses questions very sharply on a moral plane. It says, we stand for truth against officially enforced lies. We stand for trust between people instead of spying, informing, and tale-bearing, which starts with young children in the schools and in the homes and goes all the way through the social structure, so that you never know whether the man standing at the machine next to you or the woman in an office next to you may not be reporting some unguarded remark which you make, which goes into a dossier and may be used against it, against you. It says we uphold pride and dignity against self-abasement before the wielders of power. It speaks for freedom in place of subservience, for justice and legality against gross violations of legality and equity. It says we want independent and critical judgment instead of machine ground opinions handed down to us from above that we have to conform to, although we don't believe in it in our heart of hearts. It rejects double standards of conduct, one for public show, another for private life, one for the state, another for the individual, and worst of all, one for the rulers and another for the ruled. It asks that the means used to create a better life be suited to the projected social end. As one Polish writer said, a right cause must be fought for with right means. Now these are demands for a renovated morality. These people are concerned, they say, with truth, freedom, and reason. These may sound like many of the things which we are accustomed to hear in ethical classes, possibly even from pulpits. But in the Soviet bloc, they are linked with the demands of the masses for improvements in their material conditions and for a greater share in the direction of the national economy. That is a decisive difference. They express burning protest against the glaring and growing economic inequalities among the various categories of citizens. The governing group, whose own needs are so well taken care of, keep imposing intolerable sacrifices upon the workers in the name of future achievements and indefinitely delayed satisfaction. These socialist humanists assert that a workers' regime cannot neglect the living standards of the working people too much in favor of developing heavy industry at breakneck speed and out of proportion to the national revenue and resources. It should be clear that this line of reasoning has obvious political implications. It supports the claims of the masses against the dictates of the bureaucrats. It defends the rights of nationality to be free and independent, and if necessary, to fight arms in hand against vassalage to a foreign power, as Poland and Hungary have already done, and Yugoslavia had almost to do. Its most radical representatives insist upon the need for the working class to be supreme, not merely in ritual, not merely in the books or in the resolution, but in reality, in everyday life.
Is it any wonder that the Moscow authorities and their replicas in Eastern Europe fear these democratic and anti-bureaucratic voices? The theoretical magazine of the Soviet Communist Party, Communist, in an early issue of 1957, castigated these people in the following terms. These newly appeared reformers are appealing for reform on humanist principles of the existing social structure. And then this voice of the Kremlin answers, Leninism needs no sort of humanization, nor any of the reforms proposed by the proponents of humanist socialism. And then they go on to vituperate against them. Let me start by agreeing with this issue of the communists. Genuine Leninism needs no such humanization. However, what the humanist critics are inveighing against is not genuine Leninism, but the Stalinist violations of Leninism, which is by no means the same thing. The tenor of these dissident doctrines was well expressed in the Polish newspaper Nowa Kultura, New Culture, on April 28, 1957, after their October Revolution. The communist ideal demands the liberation of humanity and of the individual within the framework of society, from alienation in all the domains of society. The aim is to obtain the real sovereignty of the masses, to destroy the division between those who are deprived of freedom and the ruling group, which is not responsible to the people. The idea of communism, of humanism, put into life is universal. It is older than Marxism. It is the heritage of the ages. A year earlier, the noted communist writer of Hungary, Tibor Derry, declared at a Petőfi Club meeting, "We have been fighting for so many things that we have forgotten the chief thing, humanism." The struggle for the chief thing led Derry and his fellow writers to precipitate the Hungarian uprising and participate in it some months later. And today, he narrowly has escaped a death sentence and is lying at this very moment in a prison cell, serving a term of 9 years. And tonight, we pay our tribute and express our solidarity with him and his fellow humanists. The evolution of the Hungarian humanists, the socialist humanists, into revolutionary resistance shows what an explosive potential there is in this movement. Their criticism acts as the stimulator of the rising anti-bureaucratic sentiments among the people and is the intellectual herald of a direct democracy rooted in the working class. Now let us go over into the Soviet Union itself in conclusion. The Moscow lords have been much alerted by the lessons of Hungary and Poland. And when similar notes began to be sounded by Soviet authors, they hastened to take countermeasures. The most popular Soviet novel, and not without reason, has been Vladimir Dudintsev's Not by Bread Alone, copies of which you can get at the bookstore here. This novel sets forth a humanistic criticism of the bureaucracy, and Khrushchev, scenting what was in the wind, lashed out against the book and his author a year or so ago. Dudintsev is not alone. Over the past 2 years, numerous novels and short stories have appeared, all of which contrast the behavior of soulless functionaries with the warmer human qualities of other segments of the Soviet people.
I've read a lot of these stories in translation over the past year, but I'd like to tell you only about one of them because it is representative of the others. This is a story called Light in the Window. It tells about the director of a rest home somewhat like this here. And in this, well, maybe you didn't get so much rest here, but that's the intention. And in this rest home, which is supposed to be for the people, the most luxurious apartment is always kept carefully clean and always ready for the party leader. Unfortunately, he never comes, because that would mean to consort with the common people. But nevertheless, every day the cleaning woman comes in and cleans it up. The place becomes very crowded. This cleaning woman lives in a little hovel. She has no room to entertain. One night, she has a family gathering, and she takes her whole family into this inner sanctum, and they have a wonderful time. The director hears about it. He comes in at the height of their enjoyment. There are the kids, they're drinking, and the people are having a fine time in the people's rest home. And he drives them out. And as they file out, he looks into their eyes and they gaze at him. And he sees their hatred for him and what he represents. And he feels the inhumanity, the hypocrisy of his position and his action. He finds it intolerable, but he feels paralyzed. There isn't anything he can do about it. He can't lick the system. This is a brief sketch, but I think you can see how it portrays the gulf between the bureaucracy, their agents, and the ordinary people. Now, to come to the humanist movement in the Soviet zone itself. It suffers from the restrictions and repressions of the police state. Its advocates are prevented from saying directly and fully what they mean. Anyone who thinks that you can get up in the Soviet Union today and say what is on your heart about conditions in that country is either duped or is a conscious deceiver of other people. It cannot be done. As a matter of fact, if you are a Molotov and you're deposed, you can't do it. So how do you think that the ordinary person who hasn't had the power and privileges of a Molotov can do it? Stands to reason, anyone with common sense, but sometimes common sense is not evidence when the will to believe is paramount. These humanists have to talk in guarded terms and present things in sidelights for self-protection. There's much vagueness in this chaotic ferment, especially on its ideological side. It's highly charged with powerful feelings and half-formed ideas. Its spokesmen know much better what repels them in what's around them than how to get rid of these social evils. I may say that that's true of people in the communist parties in other countries as well. The intellectuals in the Soviet bloc have closer ties, at least in theory, and I think to a considerable degree in reality, with the working class, because there are many sons of workers and daughters of workers and peasants among them. And certainly the affinities between the intellectuals and workers were disclosed in the initiating role the intellectuals played in the Polish and Hungarian revolutions of 1956. But most of them have not yet arrived at a worked-out program or a clear perspective. They are groping toward enlightenment after wandering in darkness for so many years. It's quite natural that they should stammer a bit now that their tongues and pens can express some of their real thoughts and sentiments after so long a silence. And their first approaches to an analysis of Soviet reality are necessarily incomplete and uncertain, and they often wander off into petty bourgeois idealism and abstract moralizing. Deeper probing of thought, further experiences, the evolution of the struggle for democracy and socialism in those countries will enable the best among them to define their ideas more clearly and direct them to even more correct class conclusions. The neo-Stalinist hatchet men have seized upon some of these idealistic vagaries to discredit the whole movement and excommunicate it. They claim the humanist heritage of Marxism for their own, as I pointed out in the quotation from the communists. They ridicule the pretensions of the humanist writers. Now, this tussle between the two groups over the mantle of humanism may seem like nothing but a war over phrases. Actually, it is part of a continuing contest of divergent social forces. The defenders of the bureaucratic upper crust on the one side, the intellectual spokesman for the discontented masses on the other. The claims of the Kremlin hierarchs to be the repositories of humanism is as false and unfounded as their claims to be the continuators of Marxism and Leninism. A socialist humanism ought to be the enemy of bureaucratic parasitism and autocratic abuse of power, and not at all its servitor. Wherever and whenever the humanist critics of the bureaucracy in the Soviet countries oppose these, they are in the right, and we are with them insofar as we can have our voice and influence felt. When, at one extreme, some representatives of this tendency reject materialism in favor of absolute moral values or a classless democracy, they overshoot the mark and are wrong. But these theoretical errors and exaggerations, which require correction, which we as scientific socialists do not share, should not be allowed to submerge the essentially healthy and progressive character of the movement. The idealism of the socialist humanists is one of the means by which the new political consciousness of the younger generation of Soviet leaders is now being formed. It is the first, not the final formulation of their revulsion. Under the given circumstances, their moral indignation, however clumsy its theoretical formulations may be, is infinitely more worthy than any sham materialism behind which the gendarmes of bureaucratic privilege and tyranny try to conceal themselves. In this socialist humanism lies the herald of the new socialist democracy, which will one day, we hope not too distant, remove the evils of Stalinism from these countries and make them once again a beacon to which all socialists in the world can repair without hesitation or shame.
Any questions or discussion on this evening's presentation? If I can't see you, please speak up. We'll hear you.
How do they people defend themselves when they see a strike going on like that? I mean, well, how do they express themselves in their writings and their attitude toward the strikes?
Or to the class struggle in general.
Well, as a rule, if how do these liberal humanists react, or what attitude did they take in case of great strike struggles like those of 1946-47, steel strike? It depends upon the inclination of the humanists. They have their right wing, their centrists, and their left wing. If they are consistent, and I will not say that they are the most consistent thinkers in our country, they would have to refer such struggles to arbitration. That is, to look for some superior body in which the clashing interests can be adjudicated and an abstract justice be handed down. And however, there are left-wing humanists who are so influenced by the power of the labor movement and so closely tied to it that they act like class-conscious workers do. I imagine that Corliss Lamont is a person of that kind, and I imagine there are quite a number of other humanists of that type. These are the left-wing humanists. They can see that the labor movement has a right to engage in defensive actions and take measures against the superior power of the bosses. But then when it comes to international relations, you will find that then they revert to this impartial arbitration and classless morality, as in the case of the League of Nations. However, when it comes down to civil war, it's very difficult to be a humanist when there's civil war going on. As a matter of fact, it is in a liberal sense. If you want to get an excellent and incisive criticism of the predicament of liberal humanism when the class struggle reaches its highest point, I recommend that you read Their Morals and Ours by Leon Trotsky. In the Civil War in Spain, do you say that there isn't as much humanity on the side of Franco and his cohorts as there is on the side of the people fighting against Franco? Well, I would say that 99 out of 100 humanists took the anti-Franco side. Well, from that flow certain consequences. If the ends for which they are fighting are right, then the means which they use to protect themselves against Franco is correct, and all the necessary military means, including the most violent, murder and the holding of hostages and whatnot, are perhaps not pleasant, but necessary. So that the humanists can occasionally embrace the class struggle, but his embrace is a very infirm one, and you cannot count upon it because his grip is relaxed very quickly.
I wonder, is there a difference between saying a humanitarian approach and a humanist approach? Now I'll tell you why I asked the question. Some years ago in Chicago, there was a quite violent strike of garment workers, and the police brutality on the picket line was quite bad. And we went to see a professor at Northwestern University, Chicago University, who had a reputation of being a humanitarian. And he came down to the picket line and disagreed with the tactics of the strategy committee and said he would come down the picket line and march on the line and he could march peacefully and the police think that we were peaceful groups of people without attacks. What happened was he got beaten to a bloody pulp and thrown in the hootsaw along with the strikers, which changed his opinion of the forces of law and order. Would you speak of him as a humanist?
What is the difference between a humanist and a humanitarian? Well, the difference is not very great, and the two very often merge. Humanists are humanitarians. In the a humanitarian is a man who is a philanthropist, wants to do good toward his fellow being, but who, on the other side, believes that the methods of the class struggle are to be rejected. Now, this is essentially the humanist position. One might say that a humanist is a theoretically motivated humanitarian. And I don't, he's the egg out of which the humanist chicken is hatched.
Leon Trotsky, in the book, Literature and Revolution, points out that in a socialist country, we can't think of a proletarian literature, a proletarian culture. And he calls it in a socialist country, there could be a humanitarian culture, a culture of humanity. Can we say that these few books that are just now out, that this is the sprout, really, of a human culture, a beginning?
In Literature and Revolution, Trotsky remarked...
Didn't hear the question.
Well, I'm going to repeat it. In Literature and Revolution, Trotsky observed that under socialism, culture would be humanistic. Are these literary expressions which I spoke about the first sprouts of such a literature? No, they are not what Trotsky referred to at the conclusion of his Literature and Revolution. What Trotsky said is, when I will deal with this more at length in my next talk, when the level of the economy and the culture have reached the point where people no longer have to work long hours, when all social distinctions are abolished, not only different classes, but even distinctions between brain workers and manual workers, between the city and the country, between an undeveloped and developed nations, that then for the first time, when humanity has an equality of the material conditions of life, for the first time, the qualities of the human personality can flower. And then the literary expression of such people will, for the first time, be humanistic in a real sense. But I'll say more about that tomorrow. Well, if there are no further questions, since we're going on with this tomorrow, and I believe there's some jollity in the wings, let's go forward.